Upper Yampa versus Wolf.
It's yesterday, Mike.
Oop, I'm sorry.
Chief.
Sorry about that. It's, I made my first mistake. It's 09, SC 840, South Fork Water versus Town of South Fork. Are both parties ready? Just a bit of housekeeping, thank you. First, Justice Designate Marcus will be joining the court on the 10th, and she will listen to the orals, and unless she has a conflict, she will participate in the decision. Secondly, please, when you start your argument, state your name. And lastly, we do follow the time limit, so keep track of your time, because we'll have to cut you off. So, is the petitioner ready? Please proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. This is a relatively simple record in this case compared to many of the matters this court considers during its term. But there are a few important facts which we feel are dispositive of this case that I would like to highlight for the court. My client, the petitioner, South Fork Water and Sanitation District, was formed in 1977 pursuant to a court decree of the Rio Grande.
I'm sorry. Could you just state your name?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Charles Norton.
And you represent the petitioner? South Fork Water?
South Fork Water and
Sanitation District. Thank you.
Your Honor, I apologize. The South Fork Water and Sanitation District was formed in 1977 pursuant to court decree. The town of South Fork, the respondent in this case, is a statutory city that was formed in 1992. Neither of the two parties to this case have ever actually provided water service to their residents or to extraterritorial customers, for that matter. Water service in the South Fork area has been furnished on a decentralized basis through a system of either wells for individual cabins, residences, and businesses, and so forth, or it has been provided through small decentralized community systems, in which treatment is often provided at the wellhead, and then water is provided to a small cluster of houses, businesses, and so forth. The district was, and uncontradicted facts in the record, the district was the party that initiated planning for centralized water service. In 2003, it contracted with an engineering firm, Integra, and with the planning firm in order to prepare the design, a utility plan for furnishing water service to the South Fork area. This is a very extensive plan. It appears as Exhibit 33 in the record, and it calls for a centralized water system that includes a treatment plant with a sophisticated treatment system, many miles of pipe to actually deliver water to users, a system of fire hydrants, and obviously engineering calculated in order to maintain pressure for fire protection purposes and so forth. This utility plan was issued in 2003. The district then took the statutory steps required under Section 32.1.201, the Special District Act, to amend its service plan in order to contemplate this program of centralized service. So the service plan was amended in 2004, December of 2004. By unanimous vote of the Rio Grande County Commissioners, the service plan was approved, and the district then had the full statutory power under the Special District Act to carry out this program of centralized services. The district then proceeded to attempt to implement the plan. It actively sought sources of funding for the plan. It applied, for example, to the Rural Development Administration for a grant. It applied to the Colorado State Drinking Water Revolving Fund, also for grant money. It consulted financial advisors from Denver in order to help it structure a bond issue for the purposes of
installing and constructing this centralized water system. This effort produced about $2 million of a $7.8 million project that would eventually cost in order to implement the centralized water system. The dispute between these two parties then really began in 2006, when the town amended its subdivision regulations in order to compel applicants for new subdivision approval to dedicate water rights to the town, and also to design and construct a Colorado Department of Health and Environment approved system for water, which would in turn be operated by the town. Now, this contemplated a piecemeal acquisition of water systems. And as you look at the record, you will see that there were about six of these systems that were under discussion, under negotiation. Some of them would be new systems contemplated by new subdividers, for example, in the Jackson Heights area. Others would be pre-existing systems, as in the Dakota Park system.
Would you clarify for me now?
Yes, sir.
The town wasn't proposing to serve outside its boundaries. Is that right?
It was not.
Okay, so this would have been a condition of annexation, that if areas came in, they would have to bring water with them?
It would have been a condition, Your Honor, in some instances of annexation, in other instances of a new approval of a new subdivision plat.
Within the town?
Within the town itself.
Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we have a district that hasn't actually furnished or provided water, competing with a town that has indisputable authority to serve its own citizens, right? You would agree with that?
Both entities have authority to serve their own citizens. That's
okay.
Correct.
And this is not a situation where the district has issued bonds for a system to cover a service area. We're really in a situation where, in the public interest of serving the citizens, we have two governmental entities at loggerheads with each other, right? And you are claiming apparently some prior appropriation right vis-a-vis the statutes to claim the service area?
Not really, Your Honor. What we're claiming is that the statute unambiguously says that before you can serve, before you can furnish service within the territory of another municipality, as defined in the statute, you have to have the approval of that municipality. The statute is unambiguous in that regard. And I don't think that position is in any way dependent on whether or not the district somehow had priority of right temporally from 1977 on or before the town was formed. I don't think it's dependent upon that. Again, the statutory language does not speak to that issue. It doesn't talk about who had the right to engage in water service first. It makes no exception for a situation in which there is overlapping territory, in which a district is located entirely within the boundaries of a municipality. It makes no exception for any of those cases. And so our position, Your Honor, is directly dependent on the statutory language.
Mr. Norton, how do you read, or how should we read, the finding by the district court that the district lacks the financial resources to implement a water system? That's a factual finding which we have to...
Both parties at this point, Your Honor, lack that capacity. They lack the ability to pay for a centralized water system.
Now, specifically, he found that your client lacked the financial resources. So what are we supposed, how are we supposed to consider that in relationship to that that statute?
The service plan, Your Honor, contemplates different forms of potential funding. And both parties right now are in a situation where neither of them can pay for a centralized water system. And I don't believe that the statute compels this court to conclude that it is unreasonable for the district to refuse or decline to permit the piecemeal acquisition of these systems, because at that point in time when the permission is refused, the district does not have the financial capability to operate a centralized system or construct a centralized system. That finding, Your Honor, does not go to the notion of whether or not the district could operate these individual piecemeal systems. It could, and it has the same financial resources to do that as the town would, or over. And in fact, as the trial court record showed, Your Honor, the town at the time when this case was tried before Judge Gonzalez, the town did not have the financial capability to operate even the systems on a piecemeal basis, nor did it have an operator to do so. So I think it's very important to frame the issue here. The issue to us is the district reasonable in declining permission to operate and acquire these systems on a piecemeal basis?
I ask you a question, just the framing of that question, does that mean that you accept the holding of the Sheridan case? Because I thought that from your briefs you were contesting it.
Your Honor, I don't really believe that Sheridan is applicable to the statute as it exists today, that it interprets it, or that it's binding in this case. Now, I certainly emphatically believe that if we do accept the applicability of Sheridan, that the district's decision in this regard was reasonable. I do believe that.
So, your argument was basically that if we assume that Sheridan applies, that it's reasonable because basically the utility plan wasn't accepted, that your veto power is based upon the concept of the only way to serve the town is through, a non-piecemeal method. Is that right? Is that your position?
Essentially, Your Honor, although one footnote I would add to that, the town accepted the utility plan, as is reflected in Exhibit 8, just as the district had. It made it its policy. So the utility plan, together with the specifications that the district had prepared, were made the policy of the town of South Fork, just as they were of the district. And when that utility plan, as we cited in our brief, when it did not contemplate and, in fact, critiqued the piecemeal acquisition of systems, the town had adhered to that policy by action of its town board of trustees, just as the district had.
Okay, so I understand that the argument you're trying to make is that the district isn't unreasonable in preventing the town from doing what the district already decided was not appropriate, which is piecemeal, in which the town had already, in some regards, moved in that same direction by adopting the plan, I guess you're calling it. However, I just want to make it clear that in returning to the trial court findings, you're saying your argument has to be, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it's not unreasonable, even though the district court found not just that the town lacks the financial resources to implement a water system, but the district court really went beyond that. Said it had that the district has no ability, that the district has no intent in the future, and that the financial circumstance is not likely to change. So, is that correct? I mean, you're making the argument it's still not unreasonable, even though those trial court findings seem to go to the effect that even though the district will never be a player in that arena.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that, based on the evidence that was presented to the court, that that's a fair interpretation of that finding.
Now, are you referring to the way I've characterized the order, or to the way that to whether the order itself is correct?
Actually, Your Honor, I don't think that reading the finding that broadly is accurate in light of the record. The evidence was, I think, unambiguous at trial that neither of these parties at this point in time had the financial wherewithal to construct a centralized water system. That's clearly the case. And I think that's what the district court, in essence, found.
Well, I'd like to refer you to paragraph 25, where the court says, the evidence presented indicates that the district has no ability or intent to pursue or implement a municipal water system.
You know, I have to say that finding is clearly contrary to the evidence. And it's contrary to the uncontradicted evidence.
So is that a necessary first hurdle for you? I mean, if we do not find that finding is unsupported by the record, which would presumably be an abuse of discretion standard, have you then failed to meet the first hurdle that is necessary to your argument?
No, I don't think so. Primarily because of the adoption by the town itself of this policy, which directly said that they would not acquire water systems on a piecemeal basis, and that's what they proceeded to do. I simply think that as a matter of law, it is not unreasonable to refuse permission to another entity under this statute to conduct an activity which is contrary to its own stated policies, as well as those of the entity that's refused.
Well, in all due regard to that, I mean, it seems to me that the district in that position is second-guessing the legislative powers of the town. The town certainly has to be able to adjust its plans. And, you know, the pattern of development in this state has been the acquisition of wells, systems, and then the integration of them. The Denver Water Board certainly proceeded to acquire private companies, as you well know, and consolidating them into a municipal utility. So are you saying that that the district, the Water and Sand District, gets the chance now ever into the future to second-guess the service plan of another independent municipal entity that has a duty towards its citizens?
You know, Your Honor, actually, I think that that arrangement is what the legislature contemplated. I think that by phrasing the municipal permission statute the way that they did, they set up a situation where these types of instances were supposed to be resolved politically. And it's very interesting, the history that you cite to. If you look at the cases that lead up to the amendments to the municipal permission statute, if you look at the Garden Home case, if you look at Town of Sheridan itself, you'll see that in those instances, for example, Garden Home actually involved a situation in which Denver had annexed over the territory of a pre-existing water district. The court certainly assumed at that point that the district could have the capacity to serve just as Denver had the capacity and statutory power to serve. And then the legislature changed, that was a 1947 decision, the legislature changed the language of the statute provide this very unambiguous protection for entities including these water districts.
Well, I'd like to suggest to you that had to do with established water systems that were already serving within the area, not ones that might sometime in the future serve, right? So that there was some protection for bond and indebtedness, for facility infrastructure, and so on and so forth, that furnishing means actually furnishing water. You just can't, without exercising the condemnation authority, which is also in the statute, and then you would pay the just compensation available for taking away somebody's service taps, you know, the ability to get paid back for their infrastructure. Absent that, isn't a reasonable construction of the statute, meaning if you have a water system in place, then this situation applies, where the district would have the ability to stop a raid, apparently, you know, presumably, on its system. I mean, why isn't that totally, you know, the way that the legislature set it up when it said furnish means actual delivery of water is occurring in the area that is now within the conflicting territory?
Well, Your Honor, the statute is not phrased that way. It says, it talks about the approving municipality, and it defines the municipality as an entity which was formed principally to own and operate water systems, sewage systems, or a combination of the two. So the legislature had every opportunity at that point to say something to the effect of, if you're actually furnishing water service, then under that set of circumstances, you can exercise your veto reasonably. And it did not do that. Instead, it defined the entity that had to approve very formalistically. It simply said, an entity formed primarily for these purposes. And when the district obtained approval of its service plan in 2004, it was unambiguously at that point, if not earlier, an entity formed for the purpose of owning water and sanitation systems for that principal purpose. So I think, Your Honor, with all respect, the legislature knew of this type of situation. As the court has recited, there was this previous history in which there had been these pre-existing water districts, there had been annexation. In the Garden Home situation, there was no water, no sanitation service provided by either entity. And the way that the legislature chose to address that was to furnish this veto statute, which on its face is absolute. Now, the language of reasonableness that's contained, for example, in the Sheridan case, I think has a great deal to do with a very traditional problem of municipal law that this court is well familiar with, which deals with the location of utilities and the competing powers of a city, a statutory or home rule city, and a district with regard to eminent domain and with regard to the location of utilities. And what Town of Sheridan says, what it applies to, is a situation in which the town attempted to refuse to the district permission to even relocate its utilities within a municipal street unless the district paid an extortionate price for that, unless it agreed to furnish utility service to the entire town of Sheridan in exchange for that. That's what that case deals with, is those the competition between the police power in that situation, the power to control municipal streets, and on the other hand, the authority of the district to furnish sanitation service, in that instance, to its own residents. That simply did not speak to the statute as amended in 1962, in which we made the transition between the physical location of a facility, in which all of these issues of eminent domain, these issues of the competition between the police power and the powers of the district come to the fore, and in which the topic of service was addressed. And I think, Your Honor, in this current financial climate, in which in order to plan for the construction of something like a centralized water system, you need to have advance financial commitment. It's necessary to have the ability to demonstrate, for example, to a lender, that you've got a certain number of taps that are likely to come online, you've got a certain pace of growth that you anticipate, and the underwriter is willing to take a certain amount of risk on that and say, okay, we can underwrite bonds and sell them in the marketplace based upon your anticipated growth and performance. You need to be able to protect both your potential customer base, both those that you may serve in the future, just as much as you protect those that you're serving today. And the district wrote its financial plan and its service plan in a modern context in which these kinds of funding and financing concerns are extremely important. And I think in that instance, it is eminently reasonable to decline permission for this kind of...
Well, I would think there are things that the board can't do, but that these entities could do, these competing entities, like a water authority, because there is intergovernmental authority for persons, for cities, municipal, quasi-municipal entities, for districts to combine their resources and, in effect, their service areas and leverage bonds that are needed to build these kind of things. This kind of competition, however, just for the sake of exercising some notion of sovereignty, seems to defeat the legislative purpose, which has to be to serve the citizens with actual water service that makes sense. Now, I think you've appealed to us to just leave this in limbo and let the parties sort it out. But how do we do that? We have to construe the statute, and we have to give a reasonable meaning to it, right, in the public interest.
Well, Your Honor, one reasonable construction, I believe, is that, in fact, this has been relegated to a political solution. The town, for example, has a political alternative here that it could use. It can file a petition for exclusion of the entire area of the town that's within the district. And unless the voters petition to have an election on that question, then that happens as an automatic process under the Special District Act. The exclusion takes, you prepare a plan of finance for the entity with the excluded territory taken into account. And it happens automatically by court decree. And it's important, I think, in this instance, to note, Your Honor, that's exactly what happened. During the pendency...
Counsel, can I just interrupt about... Because I thought I read someplace that the town refused to amend its complaint to file petition for exclusion based exactly on the political service that you're talking about. In other words, just opposite of what you're saying right now, if I understood it correctly.
No, Your Honor, there was an affirmative defense that was in the town's pleading, which said there is an exclusion procedure pending. And when Judge Swift initially ruled on the motion for summary judgment, she noted the existence of that exclusion petition and said we can't make a final determination until the exclusion process has been resolved. Then after her order from the bench, the town subsequently withdrew the exclusion petition, and the precipitating event for withdrawing the exclusion petition was the fact that over 100 electors within the district had signed, and the town had signed a petition calling for an election, which is provided for under the statute. So to me, the first and foremost political mechanism that can be used here is this petition for exclusion, and the electorate gave a pretty strong indication that they did not intend to support it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. That would be putting the case in a different procedural process than the one that it's been presented to us in. Is that correct? In other words, we'd have to, what would happen? We would have to, dismiss as improperly granted or remand so that this amendment could be imposed in the case, superimposed? I mean, where are we procedurally with all of this, if you could help me, sir?
Well, the court, as I understand this, Your Honor, from the record, the court accepted the amendment to the pleading that withdrew the affirmative defense.
Right.
So a trial was held based on a set of pleadings in which there was no exclusion petition pending. And there was none actually pending at the time of trial, and the case was decided accordingly. So
now you're suggesting, even though that's, I just want to make sure I understand this, even though that's not the procedural posture in which we're receiving the case, in answer to Justice Hobbs's question, that might be a solution to the case. But how would we get there at this point?
Well, you know, I think that's, my point really is that as you construe the statute and decide what's a reasonable construction, when a party makes, for this particular part of our argument, a kind of radical appeal to you that says this may be one of those few instances in which the judicial role is actually quite restricted, and in which the legislature has said, under our power to allocate authority to different units of government as we see fit, which, as the court is well aware, is the prerogative of the General Assembly. They set up local government according to their own dictates, aside from home rule cities and municipalities. This may be one of those few instances, acknowledging that power, in which the judicial role is quite limited, and in which the parties are supposed to work it out. And for example, one of the responses that I also had to
well, limited in what way? Because it seems though you were arguing this is a political question, which would really suggest that we shouldn't have jurisdiction over it, that we shouldn't address the issue at all. But I don't think that's quite what you're saying. You seem to be saying that the restriction or the limitation on the court's role should somehow mean that we're much more liberal about what's reasonable, or... Tell me, what is the effect of us agreeing with you that there is a, I'm going to call it like a quasi-political question aspect to this, because I don't think you're really saying we don't have jurisdiction. Right. We shouldn't exercise our jurisdiction.
No, Your Honor, that's quite correct. And I want to make it very clear, if you disagree with me, and if you think that...
Well, let's start with, if we agree, then what does that mean?
The consequence, then, is that there was no permission given by the district, and the current status quo has to be allowed to stand as it is.
So in other words, an absolute veto power by the district that's not subject to any review. Is that what you're saying?
Not subject to judicial review on a reasonableness basis, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay. Is that the same place that your argument, you have this other argument about how Town of Sheridan doesn't apply because the statute changed and the statute is now addressing the location of services, whereas it was this police power eminent domain conflict before. If we accepted that argument, does that lead to the same place? Does that mean the veto power is absolute? Because when you were making that argument before, you seemed to be characterizing that as somehow qualifying the nature of reasonableness. But I had actually thought you were saying absolute veto power, County Sheridan doesn't apply to the new aspect of the statute.
I think I understand now, Your Honor, so I hope I respond appropriately. I don't think that this statute calls for a kind of rational basis review of the district's decision to see if it was somehow reasonable. But if the court concludes the town of Sheridan should be applied to this case.
Again, before you get to the if,
okay.
The first part, does that mean if we agreed with you, then it's an absolute veto power that's not, doesn't have to be reasonably exercised?
That's correct, John.
Okay. Now you can go on with the if.
And I'm sorry, I hope I didn't evade the point there. But if you do conclude that a reasonableness standard should be applied, I think that the district's action more than met that standard in this instance.
Your time is almost up. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Your Honor, I was attempting to, I was trying to recall because there was a point that I wished to make. Oh, in response to one of Justice Hobbs' questions that Justice Rice brought up, it's interesting, in this instance, it's the district that has a greater financial base, customer base, with its extraterritorial service outside the area of the town, has a greater financial base to bring about a centralized water system than the town does.
Thank you.
Thank you.
From the respondent.
Good morning.
Carl
Hamlin on behalf of the town of South Fork, and I want to apologize up front. I'm recovering from a rather nasty cold, and so if I start coughing, please bear with me. It's not intentional. I think it's important in this case to review briefly the trial court's findings, and I'd like to direct the court's attention to those findings specifically that were raised during the appellant's argument. I direct your attention to paragraphs 22, 23, 24, and 25 of the trial court's factual findings, which in the absence of an abuse of discretion would be the accepted facts for this case. And those in total reflect that there is no financial ability of the district to provide water services, and there is no future intent of the district to provide water services based on the factual findings of the trial court. I'd also like to clarify the record for purposes of what has been asserted that the town didn't have the financial resources to do this either. And the reason I'd like to do that is that that has been raised several times, but if you look to the trial court's factual findings, that was actually not one of the court's findings, specifically in the 40-some-odd factual findings. What it did find, which is not disputed, is that the town doesn't presently own or operate any water systems. It hasn't ever operated any water systems in the past. It does not currently provide water services to anyone, and it currently does not own any water rights, nor has it ever owned any water rights to provide services. And I think that's important because there was a great deal of discussion regarding the financial capability of these two entities. And I think I need to bring us back to that those factual findings of the trial court that are really were not argued as an abuse of discretion in as it came up through the appellate process, but really today were raised that perhaps finding number 25 was not accurate with regard to the record below. In that, going through the timeline, I'd like to do that briefly because there are some important dates and some important things that happened in response to certain events in this case. As was correctly pointed out, the district was formed in 1977 to provide sewer services. In 1992, the town was formed statutorily, and as you know, underneath that statute, it has a broad variety of powers, including the provision of water and sewer services. In 1994, the district was first authorized to provide water services, and then in 2004, it amended its service plan to include the utility plan that it discussed in 2003, having adopted in 2003. So there's no question that, while we're not arguing a primacy argument here, that these two entities almost contemporaneously in the early 90s became available to provide water services, and that nobody did that for a long period of time. In that timeline, with the adoption of the changes in the land use code in South Fork, there was an almost immediate response in 2006, which is reflected in the findings of the trial court, which was suddenly where no money had been budgeted for a water system underneath the district's budget for a period of 2 years, 3 years, counting 2006, the budget was amended to allow for a water system to be created. The reason I lay all of that out in the context of this appeal is that it reflects sort of the motives behind the operation of this veto power. Before the court are two issues. Does the municipal permission statute grant the district veto power over the town of South Fork's acquisition of water rights and private water systems? And did the Court of Appeals err in finding that the district veto was unreasonable in light of the town of Sheridan? As to the first question, the district's contention is that it is an absolute veto right without any substantive review of the facts or circumstances of the exercise of that right. This is a similar, is very analogous to what happened in the Garden Home sanitation case, in which you have a provider that isn't really providing, even though it's within their territory, and you have another provider, in this case the City and County of Denver, who annexes, so we have coterminous boundaries like we have here, who annexes, recognizes the lack of service, and moves to fill that void, reliant on both its obligations and responsibilities to provide for the health, safety, and welfare of its citizens. The district has tried to distinguish Garden Home on a couple of points. One, that it predated the statute, and two, that it was a home rule municipality rather than a statutory municipality as we have in the town of South Fork. Both of those arguments, I think, fail for a couple of reasons. The first being that really what we're talking about in Garden Home is the exercise of police powers by a municipality on behalf of their citizens. And there's nothing in the municipal permission statute that addresses or changes that underlying responsibility of a municipality to provide for and serve its citizens where service is not otherwise being provided. It's silent on that issue. I don't think it's possible to leap from the position that the municipal permission statute was designed specifically to overturn the holding in Garden Home sanitation, which was, if the services aren't being provided and you can, you should and you can provide those services. As to whether or not there's a difference between the constitutionally provided powers for a home rule municipality in this instance and the statutory municipality, those responsibilities and rights are very analogous between the provisions of the Constitution and the statutory provisions that the legislature provided to the town of South Fork to provide services on behalf of its citizens.
So can I just stop you there, because that's a point I wanted to follow up on. Just bringing you to the town of Sheridan case, isn't town of Sheridan, though, I guess you would concede that it's only talking about a constitutional conflict, isn't it?
It relates to a constitutional conflict in exercising an eminent domain right. Now, realistically, that eminent domain right is provided for, the analogous eminent domain right is provided for in the statute. And so while the facts of the case do, in fact, address specifically the constitutionally vested power of eminent domain, that underlying police power is provided statutorily as well. And so I think in that instance, the holding in Sheridan and the applicability of Sheridan to the types of powers that we're talking about here is equally applicable underneath the statute.
Well, and so let me just press you a little further on that. I mean, there's two separate places in that case where we say we're imposing this reasonableness requirement because we're concerned about the constitutional conflict. We say the statute is of doubtful validity, and then we invoke the canon that says, you know, where there's a constitutional problem, we're going to try to solve it. And basically, if a reasonable interpretation that will avoid constitutional conflict is at hand, we should adopt it, right? So what do we do with that kind of canon of interpretation that we're supposed to avoid constitutional conflicts that seems to be at the core of our concern in the case?
It's an interesting question. I think that concept or that canon of constitutional conflict, I think, may be equally applicable here, even though it is statutory. And the conflict that has arisen here is this competing interest or competing ability that was created underneath the statutory framework. And I think the idea of making the statute, giving meaning to the whole statute, if you don't apply the constitutional interpretation to that, but just simply the statutory construction interpretation, that you give meaning to the statute in the legislative scheme, the application of a reasonableness standard and the application of Sheridan is equally effective in this case. And so I guess I would argue that even if you accept that Sheridan, for argument's sake, only applies to constitutional claims, it provides some guidance on how to deal with this statutory interpretation issue that the court is faced with today and is well within its jurisdiction to decide. And I think Sheridan provides guidance on that. And I think what provides some additional guidance on that question is the line of cases relating to what does furnish mean in the Tenth Circuit. And while that is more illustrative authority than anything else, it does provide some examples of how to deal with this sort of a situation in a statutory interpretation situation. What happens in this case is, and in response to the idea of a petition for exclusion being the solution, is that we still haven't dealt with the problem. It will be back before you except 4 years from now, because if you send it back down and say it's an absolute veto right, you need to recognize that the town can exercise that same absolute veto right. The petition for exclusion, even if it fails, doesn't preempt the town from exercising that same absolute veto right. And so I would suggest to you that we may well be back in front of you in 4 years, except my client would be at this table. And
what does the petition for what would the petition for exclusion accomplish, if anything, then?
If successful, the petition for exclusion, the statutory scheme under Section 502, I believe, is fairly comprehensive, and it really goes to parceling out who's responsible for debt in an exclusion scenario, which in this case is kind of funny because there is no debt to parcel out and there's no water system to parcel out. But that's really what it goes to, is to protect in the exclusion proceeding, when those two entities go their separate ways, if you will, to protect the financial viability of the entity that the territory is being excluded from. That's really what it would accomplish. You could argue that it's a political solution, but the statutory scheme really speaks to a financial solution for the entity that is having territory excluded from it. You see that happen on a fairly regular basis when a municipality moves in and for whatever reason they do exclude or petition to exclude certain properties that are actually being served, and you parcel out who is responsible for what bonded indebtedness.
You started your comments talking about a little bit about the motivations here, and I'm curious to follow that up a little and ask you what you think, you know, what the way out of this mess is, what ought to happen here.
I really honestly think the most reasonable way out of this situation is to apply Sheridan to the municipal permission statute, find as the trial court did and that the Court of Appeals did, is that the exercise of the veto power in this instance was unreasonable by the district, and that allows the town to move forward on what for it is a legislative plan of taking in individual and requiring the dedication of individual water rights and water systems in an effort to aggregate a potentially centralized system. And I think we need to be careful that a municipal water system is not necessarily a centralized water system. It is a municipally controlled water system. And so this idea that it has to be one or the, that only a centralized system is a municipal water system, there's a connection being made there that I don't think is really there.
Okay, this is going to be a tough job anyway, and as Justice Rice is asking you to explain, this is an over-appropriated basin, the Rio Grande, and somebody's going to have to acquire some senior water rights either for direct use or for augmentation use, isn't that right?
Absolutely. It's also going to be, because it's an over-appropriated basin, it's going to be a very expensive basin to acquire those senior water rights. And so one of the tools that the town has available to it is the annexation process, as you pointed out, Justice Hobbs, earlier in arguments, to require those water rights to be dedicated to the city, to the town, rather, as a condition of annexation. It also has the ability statutorily to require those same types of dedications on subdivision approvals. Of course, in the municipal context, that's always related to your increasing the entitlements of that property, and so in exchange you want something that betters your community. And oftentimes in the annexation context, that's you want something better than you would have otherwise. And so the acquisition of those senior water rights is an important tool that the town has available to it, and more importantly, can utilize to pull in these various water systems and the water rights that are associated with them in an effort to create that larger municipal and potentially centralized system at some point in the future.
We're going, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Well, going back then to the findings of fact, you pointed out earlier the findings that the judge made about the district, but similar findings were made about the town, 28, 29, 30, about efforts the town has made to try to get some water and negotiated some agreements, and those agreements fell apart, and so you don't have those anymore. And
yes,
so it doesn't sound exactly, you know, trying to read between the lines here, like the town's making a whole lot of progress either.
You're right, Justice Rice. It is very difficult in the face of a lawsuit to consummate.
So nobody has really any water.
That's true, and it's been 4 years since the lawsuit was filed. It has definitely thrown a wrench in moving forward on these things. Those SIAs, keeping in mind the subdivision improvement agreements for the three subdivisions, are still in effect. Those were not limited in duration, as were the letters of intent to acquire. But without question, the filing of the lawsuit and the subsequent appeal of the lawsuit did significant damage to the ability of the town to be able to move forward and create this water system without question.
So can I follow up on my questions about Town of Sheridan? If we agree with you that it applies, can you help me understand the reasonableness requirement? If it applies, what does that look like? And when you actually just read Town of Sheridan, it's an extremely low reasonableness requirement. I mean, I think they basically say, or we say, that if you have some rational reason that's related to health and safety and welfare of your populace, that's going to be fine. And the problem in that case was that there was this holdout. Like, we're exercising our veto power because we just want more money. It has nothing to do with the health and safety of our citizens. Can you help me understand where that reasonableness line should be drawn? I mean, you're basically, just to follow up, I'm sorry, but saying whoever can build the system or those sorts of things should play into it. And I guess I'm wondering where the line is between just some rational basis of serving your citizens. How far do you go up from there?
I don't think I can help you a lot on how far to go up, because I don't think we need to.
Okay.
I think we're not hitting this very low bar of reasonableness in this case. And the reason I believe that is there, again, if you look at the testimony of Mr. Bilberry in the record, and I'm sorry, I can cite you where that's from. But I can point out, again, in the trial court's findings of fact, in this case, at trial, the argument essentially was, we were authorized first, so we should be the ones to do it. And that was really the end of the conversation. What you have heard on appeal has been, well, now if you go back and look at it, there were all of these other reasons which were not articulated in front of the trial court, but do appear in the record someplace in the service plan, if you look at all of the pieces of the record, as to why we did what we did. On the factual findings of the trial court, they had no current ability nor future intent, based on their director's testimony at trial, to ever provide water service. I would suggest to you that that doesn't even rise to the level of the town of Sheridan's refusal to allow somebody to lay a sewer pipe in one of its right-of-ways. That making that decision, exercising that veto power, when you have no current or future ability or apparently intent, doesn't rise to the level of reasonableness.
But you raise intent. I mean, I guess you're not impugning to the district some. Are you saying they're acting in bad
faith? I was relying on the trial court's opinion, honestly. I wasn't impugning to the district their future. And maybe, and I believe what they said is that if somebody would provide them the money, In Mr. Bilberry's testimony, if somebody would provide them the money, they would operate a system. But
it says the district has no ability or intent to pursue or implement a municipal water system. Finding number 25, which Justice Martinez asked about opposing counsel, and he said, well, that's clearly not supported by the record. That's a clearly erroneous finding. Mm-hmm. And you say that it's correct.
I would argue, yes, that it is correct. If you look to the record, if you look to the cited testimony by Mr. Bilberry and that the court cites to in Exhibits 25 to 29, and exhibits for that matter, which were B through D, and those exhibits actually have to do with the minutes of meetings where they refused to take systems that were offered to them, one with 0% financing, and I believe the other one just offered to them to operate, and in both instances they said, we don't want anything to do with it. If you take a look at those things, I think then to turn around and say another legislative body having made a decision to pursue a water system on behalf of its citizens, and recognizing that we're not talking about 100% coterminous boundaries, there are portions of the town of South Fork which do not lie within the district, a decision by the legislative body to move forward with a particular plan for the creation of a municipal water system in light of these factual findings and the testimony that went into those factual findings in the exhibits, to say now it's perfectly reasonable for us to veto it, because really what they're saying is, we don't like the system you're proposing. There has not been an argument made that system being proposed couldn't eventually result in service to the citizens. None of those arguments have been made. It's just simply, we don't like the system that you're proposing, is really the basis that you heard articulated today for it being a reasonable exercise of the veto power.
But I guess what's always confused me about this case is there's no system out there. So, I mean, isn't that correct? So how can they not like a system that doesn't exist? And how can, am I just missing the boat here somehow?
No, okay. I don't think so. I think therein lies the problem that the town had both at the trial level and at the appellate level with this case, quite honestly, is that we're simply trying to acquire systems to ultimately put this together, and that gave rise to a lawsuit underneath the municipal permission statute alleging that we couldn't do that because we had not asked for permission and that veto was absolute. I share your...
From just reading these findings of fact, it would appear that the district was offered some water rights and turned them down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the basis for this finding, that they have no intent.
Mm-hmm.
You tried to get some water rights and they expired.
That's not entirely
That's
true.
Not quite.
There are, I believe, three current subdivision improvement agreements that are still in effect that, assuming a favorable outcome at this court, we could move forward on.
Well, I'm just looking at finding number 31, which says two of them have expired.
But those were the letters of intent.
Yeah.
Those did not relate to the subdivision improvement agreements, which were entered into with individual developers.
So if we were to weigh, they have nothing and you have one letter of intent. Is that what it boils down to?
I don't think that
really
is necessarily what it boils down to. I think what it boils down to is, can one legislative body substitute its judgment absolutely for another legislative body in the interests of its citizens' health, safety, and welfare?
It seems that at some point it could, and I think that's pretty obvious. And I think what's troubling here is, aside from the fact that nobody really seems to have a good plan of how to go forward, and that both entities are in here fighting instead of working together, which we can't really help you with. Aside from that, it seems as though that if the district didn't have this finding, that they have no intent to put a plan together. In other words, if they had something, if they had a finding less severe, then it might very well be, as they're arguing, that it's reasonable for them to say the piecemeal approach is not right, and we have this other approach, and it may take a long time, and our plan may not be very good, but at least we've got something. That'd be a very different scenario for you, and I think it illustrates what's troubling here, is they may very well be right on some level about the power to veto a piecemeal approach, but perhaps not when they have nothing to offer in lieu of that. And I wonder if you could address that. Is that a fair assessment of this case and why you were troubled by it?
A mostly fair assessment of the case, mm-hmm. if I may respectfully disagree a little bit with that. And I think where it's
I hope so.
Can I disagree or respect?
Both.
In a vacuum, if that were the only finding and the only evidence on the record, I mean, recognizing that that is a conglomeration of a variety of evidence in the record, I think you're right that this might be a different conversation. If that were the case, and if they were furnishing at any level anywhere currently any kind of water service, I mean, I think we would probably be having a slightly different conversation if there was a pipe in the ground anywhere that was operated by one or the other parties. I think that has a significant impact without question. And so really what you unfortunately are faced with is a situation where you have two competing plans, and essentially one is saying, well, our plan's better than your plan, and we should use our plan, and there's a statutory mechanism to potentially make you use our plan rather than your plan.
Well, what makes it worse is it doesn't seem to be any financing for either.
That's true, but there is one distinguishing characteristic which on a municipal level, as in an incorporated town, that we can require those dedications. I mean, we have a mechanism that doesn't actually cost anything to start advancing the ball, and we have actually done that in the case of these subdivision improvement agreements requiring the dedication of both systems and the dedication of water rights. And I think it's important to go back because that land use code actually requires that those systems be built at a certain standard, and we don't quibble with the fact that we designed those to be built to the district standards. It's not necessarily a bad standard. We're just trying to get there. We're trying to provide water to our citizens, and you're right. Nobody's really getting there very fast, and I would argue that in the town's case, we were on the cusp of doing that prior to November 29th, 2006, when we were served with the complaint in this case.
How does South Fork get water now?
It's a variety of separate individualized systems. Some of them are CDPHE compliant. There are over 20. They're considered public water systems. Some of them are smaller than that and are simply well systems. One of the concerns the town has always had is that, as Justice Hobbs pointed out, this is an over-appropriated basin, and it's unclear how reliable any number of those systems are, but the goal was...
These were developer systems that were turned over to homeowners, basically?
They were. Or just in the case of, you might have a trailer park where a well has been drilled and just has sort of grown over time on that well permit to provide for those additional units or housing. The more modern systems are developer designed and turned over to HOAs or continue to be developer operated.
Wasn't the solution to this, Justice Rice asked, in the near and long term to have some kind of intergovernmental agreement here between these two governmental entities and set up a water authority and go after this thing?
Quite possibly it is, but it's really hard to get people to marry each other.
Well, we had these roaring gaming towns, right?
Right.
The competing condemnation thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of said, well, wait a minute, there are solutions in the statutes for you to take care of this. We're not going to empower one entity over the other. What do you say to that kind of analogy?
I think that it would be great if we could achieve that result. I don't think and that may ultimately be the solution, unfortunately, that's not the case in front of us, and the issue in front of us, if you will. And I don't know that an outcome that overturns the Court of Appeals and the trial court decision would result in that solution. I would argue likely that would result in no water service ever being provided on an integrated basis in the town of South Fork.
And because, why is that?
If for no other reason, just looking at the history between these two entities. I mean, you can always hope for the best, but there really doesn't appear to be an interest on...
But why is it better if we affirm it?
I think if you affirm it, at least from my client's perspective, they can control and continue to move forward on the acquisition of systems through dedications. And obviously, a number of things occurred in the intervening time period where the economy declined precipitously and development and growth have not been what were projected at the time that, say, the land use code was adopted, but they still have the ability to require those dedications as people come in to increase their entitlements. They have the ability to take those affirmative steps forward. They have the ability underneath the current three subdivision improvement agreements to take over those systems if they so choose to underneath the terms of those agreements. So there begins to be the initial pieces to move forward within the town to provide that water service. And keeping in mind, again, that the town is not completely within the district. There is a section of town that lies outside of the district boundaries. And so for this town to be able to provide water and water services to its residents in an area where they feel it is incredibly important to start moving forward on this, affirming this decision allows them to continue to move forward on a plan that started with the changes in their land use code in the early to middle 2000s. That's what affirming this case does for the town of South Fork. I think overturning this case, as I said, I think really means, one, it creates a real conundrum for all of the municipal and special districts as to how to deal with this permission statute and even the question of exclusion potentially in the future. I mean, how does that play out when you have this absolute unfettered veto power that is not constrained by any sense of reasonableness? And I really believe in this case that it will result in nobody moving forward on these water systems, given the history that you've seen in the factual findings that the district does not want to take in piecemeal systems. The only mechanism available to either one of these entities right now is dedication. The only systems available to either one of these currently, and the only water rights really available to them, are these smaller systems, which the town has moved down the path of trying to acquire and has an interest in at least three at this time. So from our perspective, this is a matter of being able to actually preserve and protect our citizens and move forward on what we believe the town of South Forks believes is both its right and responsibility to serve the public safety, health, and welfare of its citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank both council, and we'll take a 15-minute recess and return to hear the second case set for this morning.